Welcome. Nice to be learning with you this morning. I will tell you there are two reasons why I was drawn to this topic for this session. One is that I've been doing a lot of teaching with the Hartman Institute on issues of Jewish peoplehood and this question of collective identity in an age of radical individualism. And the second reason is that I've always been drawn to issues of the body.
Don't come on this up.
Maybe you should wait. So we end right at 10. Yeah. So, and I have about two hour seminar here that I'm going to condense into 55 minutes. So I'm going to get started. So I've always been really fascinated by rituals that involve the body and the symbolism of the body in Jewish thought throughout history. And so I've always been fascinated by circumcision, both because it's quite a, in some ways, dramatic and troubling ritual, and the fact that it has been so enduring, and that it's a ritual that has been practiced despite assimilation, despite, you know, all of the potential ethical issues that would prevent Jews from doing this ritual. We see a consistent, I think I saw a statistic recently, is well over 90% of Jews are continuing to circumcise their children. So why is that? And what are the various meanings and symbolisms of this ritual throughout history? That is going to be my question today. And I want to frame it first by presenting a way of thinking about Jewish identity in the modern world that Moshe Halbertal spoke about and wrote about in a really phenomenal article. He wrote an article in a book that came out on Jewish peoplehood called Jewish Peoplehood, Change and Challenge. And he wrote an article in that book called On Modern Jewish Identities. And in that article, he argued that what is particular and important to note about Jewish identity in the modern world is that Jewish identity is radically pluralistic, there's a multiplicity of Jewish identities in the modern world that does not exist in the pre-modern world. And he identifies three, though I'm sure together we could probably identify more categories. But he identifies three categories. He calls them covenantal, national, and cosmopolitan. And what he says in the modern world is that it is actually possible to have a plurality of Jewish identities that are incommensurate. And he's talking particularly in that article about the issue of conversion in Israel and the complexity of conversion in Israel. If you have a multiple way, if there are multiple ways to identify Jewishly in the modern world, what are the entry policies for becoming Jewish? Primarily in the Jewish state, the entry policies are through the halachic, there's also the right of return. So there's multiple ways, but when we talk about conversion, primarily we're looking at the covenantal identity of Judaism, which is covenantal would be Judaism as a religion. Your identity is based on your standing before God in obligation, mitzvot, Torah, faith. That's the covenantal Jewish identity, but that there are other identities. So national identity could either mean your Zionism and your relationship to Judaism through your sense of loyalty and solidarity with a nation state for the Jewish people, but it could also be kind of the peoplehood column. National, not just meaning a political identity, but a sense that your belonging and your connection to Judaism is through your relationship and loyalty to a people. And the third category, which Moshe Halbertal calls cosmopolitan identity, is what we often would call social justice Jews, or your identity with Judaism based primarily on Tikkun Olam and your understanding that based on the particular historical experience of Jews as marginalized and oppressed, that has shaped a particular moral perspective in the world, and that Jews acting as social critics in the world, and Jews fighting for others who are marginalized and oppressed being the center of one's Jewish identity. And he does this interesting thought experiment in this article where he tries to prove why we can argue these three different orientations of Jewish identity can stand independently in the modern world. So he says to himself, could I imagine if I no longer believed in God and I no longer believed that Torah had any role in my life, could I still identify Jewishly? Why, yes, I can, because I have the national component of my identity, my Zionism, my sense of Jewish peoplehood and solidarity. Okay, could I imagine that if I no longer believed in the Jewish faith and religion, and I was an anti-Zionist, that I could still have a Jewish identity? Why, yes, I could, because I could imagine myself understanding through my experience of Jewish history that my standing in the world as a social critic and fighting for social justice, particularly coming out of the historical Jewish experience, shapes my identity, and that's my kind of cosmopolitan Jewish identity. Now, he admits, and I think we all know, that for most Jews, certainly for those of us in this room, that we are all a hybrid of these three components, that we all have a mosaic identity that includes elements from all three of these aspects of Jewish identity. But the idea that it is possible for these forms of Jewish identification to stand independently is one of the important, please pass these up. One of the important kind of innovations of the modern world. So this could lead, we could do a whole seminar on Jewish peoplehood and Jewish identity in the modern world, but as I'm reading this article, I'm thinking to myself, isn't it interesting that these three categories of Jewish identity in the modern world could also map out the three different ways that people understand the ritual of circumcision. So what I'm going to try to do as I present these texts on circumcision is argue perhaps the reason why circumcision has been such an enduring ritual throughout our history is that it is a ritual which can be understood in radically different ways and has been understood in radically different ways throughout Jewish history, and perhaps has meaning and relevance to Jews, whether they identify as Jewish through their religion or whether they identify as Jewish through their kind of peoplehood and communal loyalty or political identity, or whether they identify as Jewish because of their ethical, moral, kind of social justice orientation. So I'll start with the national Jew. Usually when I study these texts with lay leaders, I'll do this as a two-hour seminar. We'll really learn the text together. What I'm hoping to do in this class is to give you a source packet that will be useful to you in your teaching. So please feel free to kind of put your own logo at the top and use these sources. So I'm going to work through them quickly, and ideally we would be reading these texts out loud together and really discussing them. But I'm going to make the case for category number one, orientation number one, covenantal Jew, pretty quickly. We start with Genesis 17. When you ask students to read through this chapter, Genesis 17, and ask them what is the common motif that emerges as you read this chapter? What is the meaning of circumcision? If you look at the repeated theme, what is the repeated theme? Since I'm doing this quickly, I'm not going to have you do the exercise. I'll just give you the answer. The repeated theme is b'mod m'od, right? Zera, zera, zera. Over and over again, we have the word zera. We have the idea of offspring. We have the idea that God, as God's part of the covenant, will make you exceedingly fertile, right? Hamon goyim. Over and over, this is repeated. So what is the connection between the brit that God is promising and the obligation to do brit milah? So keep that in the back of your mind, this idea that there's a promise in chapter 17 of Reshit, a promise of great fertility, alongside the command to do brit milah. What might be the connection? Maybe it's very obvious, but now I'm going to make it, I think, even more obvious. One of the ways, and you know, what we're teaching our students, one of the ways to try to understand the meaning of any Hebrew word or any Hebrew concept is to look for its recurrence in other places in the Torah. So where else do we have the concept of foreskin or the Hebrew aral? We actually have in quite a few interesting places. So if you look on page 4, Leviticus 19, we have aral, foreskin, as connected to trees. So here, if we had the time and we were teaching our students, we would read this and ask them, what does it mean that these trees have foreskin? Why would they use that term, that concept, that you can't harvest from new trees while they are foreskinned, but you have to wait until the fourth year when it will then bear fruit? And only in the fifth year may you use its fruit, so that its yield to you may be increased. Okay, so keep that in mind. We saw in Genesis 17 the idea that the covenant involves circumcision of the foreskin, and the flip side, God's end of this bargain, is that God will make us exceedingly fertile. Hamon goyim bim'od me'od. Now look at Exodus 6. Again, I'm doing this much more quickly than you would if you were teaching this, but in text number 3, again, we have the term aral, and it's in reference to aral spatayim, that Moses can't speak because he is of foreskinned lips. Jeremiah 6, the prophet complains, I can't bring your message to your people because they are aral, arela oznak. Their ears are foreskinned. In Deuteronomy, this is my favorite, in Deuteronomy 10, we have, if you turn to verse 16, umaltemet orlat levavchem. Cut away the foreskin of your hearts and be stiff-necked no more. So here in Deuteronomy 10, what does God demand of us? To walk in God's ways, to love God with all of our heart. And what prevents us from being able to do that? Because we are of orlat levavchem. We have foreskin on our hearts. So foreskin on the trees prevents the trees from being strong enough and fertile enough to be fruitful. Foreskin on Moses' lips prevents Moses from being able to speak. Foreskin, these are figurative, right? Figurative foreskin on the ears prevents the Israelites from being able to hear God's message. Foreskin on the heart prevents us from being able to be fully faithful and obedient to God. So what does foreskin on the penis prevent? Being as fertile as we can be, right? To me, this is clear as day. I mean, I think this is like a clear case here that from the biblical perspective, the meaning of circumcision is about fertility. That things that have foreskin, the foreskin is an impediment to the proper functioning of the organ. That foreskin on the ear prevents us from hearing. Foreskin on the heart prevents us from being faithful. Foreskin on the lips prevents us from being able to speak. Foreskin on the penis prevents us from being able to be procreative, you know, fertile. So what I'm arguing is that from the biblical perspective, Brit Milah was about building a nation. We might call, if we're trying to, and I know this is a little coarse, but I have seen it yield fruit in conversation with students when they think about Brit Milah and peoplehood, that perhaps here we're talking about the national orientation of Jewish identity. Brit Milah is about building a people, about being fertile, building a nation. What's fascinating to me is that when we move to the rabbinic period, it's a completely different understanding of the meaning of Brit Milah. We move to the rabbinic period, and if we look at text 6 and 7 on page 5, Brit Milah is about something very different than having lots of children and becoming a hamon goyim. Brit Milah is about curbing lust and control, self-control. This is a great, there are three great proof texts for this. The first is in Sukkah, where Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says, the evil inclination, Shiva Shemot Yeshla LeYetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara has been called seven things. And then they give all the seven things. What does Moshe call the Yetzer Hara? He calls it Arav. He calls it foreskin. As it is said, Maltem et Orlat Levavchem. Circumcise the foreskin of your hearts. So somehow foreskin is connected with the Yetzer Hara. So what will happen if we do Brit Milah? If we circumcise ourselves?
Or self-control.
We will be able to cut away the Yetzer Hara, and then the Yetzer HaTov will win out. More evidence of this in Nidarim. This is the great, and I know these texts are probably familiar to you. Rabbi Ami ben Abba said, first Avram is written and then Abraham. And what's the difference? The difference is the hay, which has the numerical value of 5. So it says, originally, Avram had control over 243 limbs. That's the numerical value of Avram. And once we add the hay, now he has control over 248 limbs, which was, by the way, the rabbinic understanding of how many positive mitzvot there are, and that this is the number of limbs or Oregon, I don't know exactly scientifically or anatomically they understood this, but they like this number of 248, that circumcision enabled us to get to 248, to have control over all of our limbs, and what it, once we took away the foreskin, what do we now have control over? The eyes, the ears, and the membrane. So how do we understand that? What does it mean now to have control over your eyes and your ears and your organ? I think it's also about self-control. The eyes and the ears, when you look at those verses about idolatry, don't let your eyes lead you astray, right? It's, these are the organs that, or the parts of the body that potentially could lead to temptation. What we see, what we hear, our sexual impulse. And that circumcision is a tool for self-control. And I think the best proof text and one of my favorite texts about circumcision, because it's fun to teach, people can picture this, is the text in the Makot. So, Tani Rabbanan, Habibim Yisrael Shesvivan Makash Baruch Hu B'mitzvot. How beloved are Israel that God has surrounded us with mitzvot to fill in on their heads, to fill in on their arms, tzitzit on their garments, mezuzot on their doorposts. Concerning these, David said, 7 times a day do I praise thee because of thy righteous ordinances. And, let's do this one because this is really funny. B'sha'ah shenichnas David lebeit hamirchatz, in the moment that David entered the bathhouse, v'ra'ah atzmo omed arum, and he sees himself standing naked, amar oili she'emod arum b'lo mitzvah. Oh no, I'm standing here without a mitzvah. V'kevan shenizkar b'milah shebitzarah mit yashva dato. His mind is set at rest once he remembers his circumcision. So let's go back to the beginning. Why is it so beloved that Israel is surrounded by all these mitzvot, the tefillin, the mezuzah, the tzitzit? And what's the problem when David enters the bathhouse? And the bathhouse, of course, doesn't have a mezuzah on it. Of course, when you go into the bathhouse, you're not wearing your tzitzit or tefillin.
These are all ways of being reminded about discipline.
They're all reminders of an invisible God that then does what to us when we are reminded of them? What's that?
It protects us
from sinning, right? The idea is, and this is a very kind of core central rabbinic theology, that we are in a constant inner battle between our Yetzer Hara and our Yetzer HaTov. And what are the mitzvot? The mitzvot are tools, spiritual tools of self-control that helps us win that battle so that Yetzer HaTov can win out over the Yetzer Hara. Well, I am without my armor. I'm without my armor when I go into a bathhouse because I don't have all these mitzvot that are going to protect me from sliding into sin. Ah, no worries. I look down and I see my circumcision. Of course, we're talking about men, which is a whole side conversation about where women fit into this picture, but it's not my topic today. But David looks down and he's like, okay, I can control myself because I have that reminder that's always with me.
Yeah, it's reminding that, you know, also in sexual intercourse, right, you're without your reminders of mitzvot, and I was reminded of when you were speaking just now, but I think Levinas is a take on circumcision that, you know, masculinity is like the source of all violence in the world, and in a post-Holocaust context, that the sort of virile, you know, masculine, and the penis is like the source of violence, and so circumcision is sort of a reminder to every man, lest you think to use your strength for violence. Mm-hmm. There's somebody more powerful than you, and
nice.
He controls your genitals.
So let's come back to that when we get to Rambam, because I think it's somewhat related to Rambam, but I think it's also related to this. The idea that, and what's striking to me is how radically different this is from the biblical understanding of reading law, which had to do with fertility, procreation, that this would actually, this procedure would be a tool to help you in, I think, in your sexual potency, and at least in the way that it leads to procreation. And for the rabbis, it's almost the opposite, which is no, circumcision is meant to curb your lust, to help give you tools of self-control to prevent sin. That's one move in the rabbinic period on this mitzvah. There's a second move, which is fascinating, perhaps a little later in rabbinic Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, what people say 8th century, some earlier, it's hard to date, but And Lawrence Hoffman writes a lot about these sources in his book, The Covenant of Blood. Someone want to read for us, this is a different perspective on the meaning of circumcision. Someone want to read 9a? Volunteers, please.
On the day when the children of Israel went forth from Egypt, all the people were circumcised, both young and old, as it says, for all the people that came out were circumcised in Jethro. The Israelites took the blood of the covenant of circumcision and put it upon the lintel of their houses. And when the Holy One, blessed be He, passed over to plague the Egyptians, He saw upon the lintel of their houses the blood of the covenant of circumcision and the blood of the Paschal Lamb. And He was filled with compassion on Israel, as it is said, when I passed by you and saw you wallowing in your blood, I said to you, in your blood live. I said to you, in your blood live. In your blood, dam, is not written here, but in your damim, plural, in twofold blood, the blood of the covenant of circumcision and the blood of the Paschal Lamb.
This is incredible, right? This is a great midrash on what happens, right? We know in Exodus the idea that you're supposed to put the blood on the doorpost so the angel of death will pass over the homes of the Israelites. And what blood, in the book of Exodus, what blood are they putting on the doorpost?
The Paschal Lamb.
They slaughter the lamb for the Pesach, and they put the blood on. But the midrash says there's damim, is plural. There's two kinds of blood they put on there. They put the blood of the Paschal Lamb and the blood of circumcision, this idea that they all circumcised themselves before the Exodus. Of course, there's some that say, like Joshua, they had to all circumcise themselves before they went into the land. But what's interesting about this midrash is its understanding of the symbolism and meaning of circumcision. What would you say is the purpose and the meaning of circumcision according to this midrash? Why would we do a Brit Milah? Or what does Brit Milah signify or achieve?
Redemption.
It's salvation, right? This is about salvation. This is about redemption. It's, again, another way of protection. The other rabbinic approach was protection from ourselves that we might sin. Here we have protection in the sense that we've done something, I don't know if sacramental is the right word, but we have offered a sacrifice, right? And that sacrifice, that blood of the sacrifice of circumcision will protect us. And maybe it becomes even more clear. Will you just continue and read? This is from the same source, a little later in the Midrash. Go ahead. Know that on this Day of Atonement.
You know that on Yom Kippur, Abraham, our father, was circumcised. Every year, the Holy One, blessed be He, sees the blood of our father Abraham's circumcision, and He forgives all the sins of Israel. As it is said in Leviticus, for on this day shall atonement be made for you to cleanse you. Now the very place where Abraham was circumcised and his blood remained, there the altar was built. Therefore, it is written, and all the blood thereof shall he pour out at the base of the altar. In Leviticus. Scripture also says, I said unto you, in your blood live, I say to you, in your blood live. Ezekiel. Rabbi Ishmael said that Abraham shrank from nothing that God commanded him, so that when Isaac was only 8 days old, he hurried to circumcise him. As it says, Abraham circumcised Isaac his son when he was 8 days old, and he offered his sacrifice on the altar.
Isn't this incredible? So it's clearly using Akedah kind of language. Abraham hurried to do this. Imagining that Brit Milah is a mini Akedah, and because of the merit of the Akedah, we achieve Kapara every year, and we know this tradition from the blowing of the shofar, that the shofar is supposed to remind God of the Akedah. Here, we're using that same principle, but we're applying it to Brit Milah. And the idea that Brit Milah is connected to Yom Kippur and to sacrifice, I think, is a really different perspective on Brit Milah, certainly than we saw in Genesis and in Torah, but even different than what we saw in the Talmud, where circumcision is about curbing lust and controlling your yetzer hara. Here, circumcision is a sacrificial act that helps us achieve atonement and protection. And this is Lawrence Hoffman's argument in Covenant of Blood, which I have a lot of problems with that book for. We can talk about it on the side if anyone's interested, but his argument is that there is an introduction of led to the ritual of circumcision with the kind of big adding of aspects of the circumcision ritual that will ensure that blood is a component and that it becomes kind of a halakhic necessity that there is blood. That's an innovation that is related to this time period where circumcision became about sacrifice and about kind of the salvation, the salvific power of blood symbolically through the act of circumcision. So it's interesting to think about it that way.
And especially, I mean, if they're living in Christian countries, I mean, rather being circumcised, you know, is a public announcement. It isn't like today where, you know, your kid goes into the gym and he's the same as everybody else, right?
True. Very true. And you know who? If you're interested in reading more text, so the Shia Cohen wrote a book, Why Aren't Jewish Women Circumcised? It's pretty dense. I tried to lead a study group through this book where we read chapters, but it was a little academic for a lay audience. But it's a great anthology, very interesting sources, Christian and other, that kind of trace the meanings of circumcision. And he also talks a lot about this aspect of it. So I want to wrap here. Yes.
Circumcision being medical procedure, there had to be in ancient times a high risk of death. And I'm wondering if that's
true. I don't know if that's true, because you see, even in the Talmud, they start to talk about, you know, if there's if you have a child who dies from circumcision, which would be very rare, but if someone had hemophilia, had that kind of blood disease, it is possible. And so then I forget if it's after one or two children that die, then they tell you not to circumcise your child because they must have understood a little bit about genetics, but I don't think, I'm not sure, I don't think so.
When I was in the Navy, I had two sailors in my office. They said, looking for someone Jewish. So I said, well, you found me. I said, well, we're having medical, we're Christian, but we're having medical circumcisions done at the U.S. Navy Hospital tomorrow. We wanted to find somebody who was once circumcised. We thought we'd find the rabbi. I said, listen, I couldn't walk or talk for a year.
So far we have looked at the biblical approach to circumcision, which I think we could line up with the orientation of Jewish identity, which is the national orientation, that Judaism is about creating a people, a nation, and in the biblical mindset, circumcision would lead to our fertility as we're building this great nation. We move to the rabbinic period, to the Talmud, and circumcision clearly is square in the covenantal orientation of Judaism. Judaism is about mitzvot. It's about obedience to God. It's about curbing your yetzer hara, or it's about sacrifice and offering yourself up to God and being obedient in that way. There's one more rabbinic voice that I think might offer a way of thinking about circumcision that speaks to the third orientation of Jewish identity we discussed, which is the cosmopolitan Jewish identity. And that, I know you all know these midrashim, and if we ever have to put a midrash out of Brit Milah to give a Devar Torah out of Brit Milah, these are the ones that, at least for me, that are most resonant for a modern Jew, and this is the notion of Brit Milah as a form of tikkun olam, or as a symbol of our role as Jews in the world to partner with God in the act of tikkun olam. So we have the great midrash in Reishi Rabbah, everything which was created in the 6 days of creation needs work. I didn't give you the Hebrew from the beginning, right? The beginning is the typical motif. The pagan philosopher asks Rabbi Oshaya, if circumcision is so beloved of God, why wasn't Adam created already circumcised? And the answer is because everything that was created in the 6 days of creation was, in a sense, unfinished. Mustard needs sweetening. Wheat needs grinding. Afilu Adam sarich tikkun. Even man needs tikkun. And then you have the great parallel midrash in Midrash Tanhuma with the same motif. The tyrant Rufus asked Rabbi Akiva, whose works are more beautiful, those of God or those of human beings? Rabbi Akiva says, perhaps surprisingly, those of human beings are more beautiful. And then the tyrant comes back and says, why do you have yourself circumcised? And Rabbi Akiva says, I knew you were going to ask me that question, which is why I preempted you by saying the works of human beings are more beautiful than those of the Holy One. To prove his point, Rabbi Akiva brings ears of grain and delicate woven challahs, and says the ears of grain are the work of the Holy One. The beautiful challah loaves are the works of human beings. Are not the challah loaves more beautiful? And he brings raw flax and beautifully embroidered garments from Beit She'an, which was the capital of the textile industry in ancient Israel. And he says, the first are the work of God, the second the work of man. Are not the garments more to be admired? So this is the whole theology, that God gives us the raw material of creation, and we take on the role of finishing and improving upon God's creation. And what I think is so interesting here is to think about the mitzvah of circumcision as a way of saying even the human body is not a finished creation, or the male human body is not a finished creation, but that on the eighth day, we do this symbolic act to kind of finish our human body as a sign of entering the covenant with God, where the covenant is about partnering with God in the work of Tikkun Olam. But we start with our own body. And it's very symbolic, right? God creates the world in 7 days. It's on the eighth day that humanity takes over and says, now we're in charge of creation, and we will do the work of finishing creation from here forward. And I think that this understanding of circumcision can speak very much to the modern Jew who has that cosmopolitan orientation, that being Jewish is about recognizing that the world is an imperfect place and that it is left to our hands, to our human hands, to do the hard work of Tikkun Olam. Any thoughts here before we move to Maimonides? Please, David.
Well, I was hoping we would get into what you said was like a side conversation, but I think it's pretty germane to how women approach this and how, you know, are women excluded from this? What are different ways that women can or can't participate in this area of mitzvah, which is quite frankly under severe attack these days amongst circles that liberal Jews are living in? I think it is an important discussion to think about that. So I don't know if you're going to do that now or at the end.
I think it's absolutely an important discussion. I think there's always kind of two, for me, in my own life, in my own teaching and thinking about these, there's kind of two layers, which is, let's look at what we have in the tradition and see what are the meanings and symbolisms of theology that can still speak to us as modern Jews, even if it was created at a time that was intensely patriarchal, and therefore it is a given, of course, that the covenantal rituals would apply to men and not to women, or that women gained their status in the quote covenant through being daughters or wives because it was a patriarchal society. So to me, that's kind of a given, and I don't need to necessarily throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have a ritual which is focused on men because it was a patriarchal tradition, and yet it's a ritual that is steeped with deep meaning that applies to me as a woman in the modern world.
How so?
Because I, too, can relate to the idea of building a Jewish people. I can relate to the idea of the mitzvot as tools for controlling the Yetzer Hara, and I can relate to the idea of our covenant with God being about partnering with God in the work of Tikkun Olam. Even if this particular ritual doesn't apply to my physical body, it's a ritual and an idea that emerges from my tradition that I can appreciate and celebrate, and certainly my sons, when they had their circumcisions, that those were meanings and symbols that were meaningful to me. Now, does it mean that I need to have an equal and powerful physical ritual for my daughters? For me, it does not mean that. I understand that for some it does. It doesn't for me. I don't know that I can explain it other than that that it doesn't. It doesn't.
I think that you could come up and say, women participate in this because if they have children of their own, right, that they are connecting to someone physically and producing male children who will participate in that. But that said, to me, it's not creating a ceremony that's powerful enough for daughters.
No, but that's the second question. So how do we create meaningful baby-making rituals for girls? It's a whole separate question, which I think is extremely important. It's not the topic of this session, which is exploring the different symbolisms and meanings of the baby love, but I feel very passionate about that, and I think for when we had a daughter, I think we created a most beautiful baby naming ceremony that we took very seriously. But I think
it's... Did you try to tie it into baby love?
I did not, necessarily. I didn't feel that need. But I can understand why somewhat. and I don't want to be dismissive of this issue. It just, you know, I feel like it's almost, I can't do justice to both aspects of this question in 1 hour, but I absolutely think it's a really important question. I think the whole question of how we create new rituals and that whole field of creating rituals is really complicated and really important. And I know that there are people much more wise and experienced in that area that have given a lot of thought and have written really important things about that. It just wasn't the focus of this particular study.
What do you make of the story of Moshe and Tzipora and the Chatan Damim?
That is really interesting. And that could argue, and as well as the Dina story, right? Because there's other places we could find. I was making a case that when we look at biblical Judaism, circumcision and foreskin is about procreation, but I think we can locate also some of these other voices in the Bible. Certainly the salvific nature of circumcision, yes, I think we see in that story, and I think in the Dina story we see the kind of peoplehood concept that, you know, if you want to be part of our tribe, you have to have this mark that we all have. So yes, this, and we all know the Torah, the Tanakh is not like univocal, it's, you know, there's multi-vocal dimensions to almost everything in Judaism, even within the Torah itself. So yeah, I mean, I think to do a fair, really extensive search on this, we have to include those stories.
Yeah, and if I could just comment about the salvation, and the comment about Christian context, and salvation through blood, right, this is the blood of Jesus Christ, like the athletic idea of like in consuming in your body, that purifies you, that I achieve salvation through blood. I've always found that powerful. I mean, not my cup of tea, but I find that concept of blood being maybe not as compelling for the modern Jew, but I think if you think about issues of body and pregnancy and blood, miscarriage and the experience of, I think there is something that in a Brit Milah that could be reparative in a salvation kind of purifying way after the ordeal of childbirth, right? To have a purifying ritual with blood, I think could be. I haven't yet figured out how to package it.
There are some that will argue that the 7 days and the circumcision on the 8th day related to the woman after giving birth to a boy being in a state of tumah for 7 days, right. And then the 8th day. That it's connected. Absolutely.
Yeah, I haven't figured out how to package that in a way that would be tenable, but I could imagine that it has real power for somebody who's experiencing a need for some sort of purification through blood, for the blood that has been so much a part of the experience of trying to bring a child into the world.
I hear you. It's interesting. Think about it. I mean, getting back to, I think, David's question, when you read, if you look at Shai Cohen's book on why Jewish women aren't circumcised, there have been various attempts, you know, besides the just it's a patriarchal tradition, and we just have to, you know, understand the historical context in which this was created. I want to say it's the Bahor Shor, but I don't remember exactly, who suggests that women's menstruation is the equivalent to male circumcision because it's also related to blood, and that a woman enters the covenant, in a sense, through menstruation and through mikvah. I don't know, my challenge with that is that not every woman is fertile. Not every woman, you know, so to say, but I guess it's true of men. And if we're going to say that Genesis 17 is really about procreation and fertility, but I, as a modern, wouldn't want to really introduce rituals around that for the sake of comparable rituals, because I think it's kind of problematic. Yes.
In today's world, with over 50% of marriages winding up with interfaith marriages, and as you're describing, circumcision ties us into a Jewish community. Mm-hmm. These people who are sidestepping the Jewish community, still, they feel the need sometimes to circumcise their children, even though they give it up walking in the way of Judaism.
So, this is a great segue to Maimonides and to Soloveitchik, our last two texts. Finish your question.
Well, how does that tie us all in together? That people are kind of stepping away, and we're in our businesses,
right,
realizing the loss of the population.
Right.
How does that tie people who have stepped away into
What's so fascinating to me about circumcision is, you know, I open today with this orientation of Jewish identity in the modern world that Moshe Halbertal introduced with covenantal Jew, national Jew, cosmopolitan Jew. And all of those are interesting and principled and rich identities in and of themselves independently. But the reality is we have a fourth category of the nons that the research report talks about that don't identify Jewishly in a deeply principled way. They might just identify Jewishly in a loosely assimilated, unaffiliated way or not at all. And yet many of them are still circumcising their kids. Why? So here, let's look at Maimonides and Soloveitchik and kind of end with that, because I think that's really part of the most interesting aspect of this question about circumcision in the modern world. Like, why are people still doing it? If you're not religious, and you don't have a really strong sense of Jewish peoplehood, why would you subject your child to that? Now, part of it has to do with American medicals. You know, when you compare circumcision rates in America to Europe and other places, and it's still up there in the high 70s to 80% of Americans that are circumcising their children to this day, and we all know the medical and scientific arguments for, and those that give the psychological arguments against, but I think that the numbers are still pretty remarkable. So let's look first at Maimonides. You gotta love Maimonides. You know, I spend so much of my life teaching about how the rabbis reject the Hellenistic dualism, and a lot of what the rabbis write on sexuality is a polemic against that dualistic nature of the body and the spirit, and the rabbis embrace, the union between body and soul, and that's why we can enjoy kind of physical pleasures in life. And then along comes Maimonides, right? Like, here's Maimonides on circumcision. So, similarly, with regard to circumcision, one of the reasons for it, in my opinion, is the wish to bring about a decrease in sexual intercourse and a weakening of the organ in question so that this activity be diminished and the organ be in as quiet a state as possible. It has been thought that circumcision perfects what is defective congenitally. This gave the possibility to everyone to raise an objection and say, how can natural things be defective, right? That's the Hellenistic challenge that Rufus and the others were saying. How could you say God didn't create a perfect creation? Who are you to say that the human body is not perfect as God created it and intended it? So that they need to be perfected from the outside, all the more because we know how useful the foreskin is for that member. In fact, this commandment has not been prescribed with a view to perfecting what is defective congenitally, but to perfecting what is defective morally. The bodily pain caused to that member is the real purpose of circumcision. None of the activities necessary for the preservation of the individual is harmed thereby, nor is procreation rendered impossible. The violent concupiscence and lust that goes beyond what is needed are diminished. The fact that circumcision weakens the faculty of sexual excitement and sometimes perhaps diminishes the pleasure is indubitable. For if at birth this member has been made to bleed and has had its covering taken away from it, it must indubitably be weakened. You know already that most of the lust and licentiousness of the multitude consists in an appetite for eating, drinking, and sexual intercourse. The ignoramus regards pleasure alone as the end to be sought for its own sake. Therefore, God, may his name be held sublime, employed a gracious ruse through giving us certain laws that destroy this end and turn thought away from it in every way. He forbids everything that leads to lust and to mere pleasure. I usually choose not to read this part to my students because every teacher selects the text they want to share. But we should know that Maimonides believed that, and that that's another way to see this, and it's not so, so different from the Talmud, that believed that circumcision would curb lust and would help us control ourselves, right? The Avram to Abraham, not so different, but really elaborated in Maimonides. But to me, what's more interesting about Maimonides is the second part, which I think gets to your question about connecting to the Jewish people. He says, according to me, circumcision has another very important meaning, namely that all people professing this opinion, that is those who believe in the unity of God, should have a bodily sign uniting them so that one who does not belong to them should not be able to claim he was one of them while being a stranger. For he would do this in order to profit from them or to deceive the people who profess this religion. Now, a man does not perform this act upon himself or upon a son of his unless it be in consequence of a genuine belief. for it is not like an incision in the leg or a burn in the arm, but a very, very hard thing. It is also well known what degree of mutual love and mutual help exists between people who bear the same sign, which forms for them a sort of covenant, an alliance. Circumcision is a covenant made by Abraham our father with a view to belief in the unity of God. Thus, everyone who is circumcised joins Abraham's covenant. This covenant imposes the obligation to believe in the unity of God in accordance with the words of the law, to be of God unto thee and thy seed after thee. Thus, this purpose of circumcision is as important as the first and perhaps more important. So even though, of course, Maimonides is not talking about a secular, unaffiliated Jewish population or intermarried Jewish population, he's actually talking about a group that coheres around a common faith and common belief, which is, of course, central to Maimonides' understanding of Jewish identity, the belief in God, the perfect belief in monotheism. But I think we can read kind of between these lines and see that Maimonides is also kind of noting the peoplehood power of everyone having the same mark. You know, it's like, I don't know what the fraternity, you know, modern example would be, but a little bit like the hazing in a fraternity, that everyone's gone through that same process, that same hazing. It was painful, it was much more than just a burn on the arm or a cut on the leg. This was a serious entry ritual, and now we belong to this brotherhood, we belong to the same clan. Now for him, the brotherhood was about perfect belief, perfect faith, correct belief. But I think we could also say today, when you talk to a lot of people that circumcise their children despite not being religious in any way, often they will say, I'm afraid if my kid goes off to summer camp one day and he looks different than every other Jewish kid, that he'll be embarrassed. Right? So often people will circumcise their children even if they have some moral qualms about it, and even if they don't have the kind of religious impulse that they have to uphold of religious obligation, they still have the sense that you want to look like everyone else. You want to belong to the same club, the same tribe, and that has been an important, I think, driving force, particularly in the modern world, for people to continue circumcising their sons.
So before the Jewish people entered Israel with Joshua, they commanded to both circumcise the males and to observe Passover. Is there any comment as to which of these two reasons given by Rambam was the reason why circumcision was placed so high on the list? Was it to differentiate them from others, or was it to diminish their sexual lust capacity?
So I don't know from Rambam's perspective the answer to your question, but it raises another. I'm glad you raised it, because what you're raising in my mind is to remember to reflect on the Passover Seder and circumcision. You know, all of these population surveys, when we're looking at Jewish identity markers and indicators, it's always the most observed Jewish ritual is the Passover Seder and circumcision, right? Maybe lighting kind of the candles. But why is it that we keep observing the Passover Seder? Or why is it that we keep circumcising our children despite the multiplicity of ways to identify Jewishly or not to really identify deeply or stately in any way? And I think maybe the argument I'm trying to make today, and I'm curious if you find this argument compelling, that what makes a Passover Seder so powerful as a ritual, and maybe what makes circumcision so powerful as a ritual, is precisely the multiplicity of ways to experience the ritual. So Passover Seder, I could do the same exercise, national Jew, covenantal Jew, cosmopolitan Jew, with the Passover Seder. Why do I keep the Passover Seder? Because it's a commandment, and I read every word of the Haggadah, and it's a mitzvah. Why do we keep the Passover Seder? Because I am a national Jew, and this is the story of my people, and it connects me to my past, and it connects me to my family. Why do I keep Passover Seder? Because I'm a social justice Jew, and I remember that I was a slave, and that I was downtrodden and oppressed, and now the Passover Seder is occasion for me to think about modern-day slavery, and what, you know, and how I can serve in the world to liberate others, and how I need to be liberated, right? So there's all these different ways to experience and understand the Passover Seder, and maybe that's in part why it has been such an enduring ritual. Perhaps circumcision is dissimilar in that there have been so many different ways to understand the meaning of the symbolism of circumcision, whether it's this is the covenant that God has cut with us, right? We could have had a discussion about that, the brit bein habitarim and the brit milah and cutting and why we need to cut. But the point is that it's a covenant, it's a mitzvah, it's my obligation to God, or is it simply part of kind of a tribal mark that connects me with a people, and it's my peoplehood ritual, and I did it, and so my son has to do it. Where women fits in here, I think, is really important when we think about Brit Milah as a peoplehood ritual. I think this is where we really need to think about how are we going to ensure that our baby girls and our growing daughters feel just as much an important part of the Jewish people and that covenant of peoplehood. And then the third, of course, is this notion that we do Brit Milah as a symbolic gesture to signify what it means to be a human in covenant with God, or a Jew in covenantal relationship with God, to do tikkun olam in the world. The world is not perfect. Even the human body is not perfect. This is where David, I mean, it's a terrible way to respond, but this is where you might say, okay, a baby girl is born, A plus, perfect. Baby boy is born, A minus, needs a little tikkun. I wouldn't do that.
What would that teach?
It wouldn't. It's offensive. It's offensive. And listen, all of it's offensive if you really get to the kind of inequality here, it's problematic. So you can either highlight it and focus in on it and choose to, raise that as the focus of the question around this. What is equal treatment of boys and girls in entry rituals to our peoplehood and to our covenant? And that's, I think, a really meaningful seminar. And here, you could also just offer a seminar and say, given that we have this ritual, what are the multiple ways we can understand its meaning? What are the multiple ways historically that the Jewish people and Jewish sources have understood the meaning of circumcision? And perhaps, because there's such a multiplicity of meanings, maybe that's why it has been so enduring, because there are so many multiple ways in the modern world to identify Jewishly, to understand what it means to be Jewish and to be part of the Jewish people, that here we have a ritual that we can continue doing and still have really multiple perspectives on its meaning.
Quick question. To your knowledge, in the 19th century, even the 20th, there was such a rebellion, especially in Germany, about being distinguished at all.
Yeah.
But I see this here. But I haven't seen in the literature any definitive comments regarding eliminating circumcision as something which would differentiate people from the larger Jewish people from the larger.
Eliminating or insisting upon?
I'm sorry.
You haven't seen the literature on eliminating
circumcision? Eliminating the ritual of circumcision, so that people with Jewish names would not be at all confused with the general larger populace.
Maybe I'm just having trouble hearing. Are you suggesting that in the advent of kind of Reform Judaism, why wasn't that more?
Well, beyond Reform Judaism, in the 20th century, for example, in 20th century Germany, early Germany, first quarter of the century, there were books written with 50% of the characters being Jewish, and the word Jewish never appeared. Total assimilation was not being circumcised an important part of that, because I actually think.
So I would say, I don't know the statistics on the kind of percentage of circumcision in that time period, but when you read kind of between the lines, if you look at this last Solid Nature text, it will end with this. Clearly, it was enough of a concern that we start to see in the population of Reform Jews in Germany in the 19th century, those who are, and it makes perfect sense. If we're going to eliminate kashrut, if we're going to eliminate ritual rabbinic law, we're going to, kind of focus on Judaism from a more cosmopolitan perspective, this kind of ethical monotheism, of course eliminating circumcision makes complete sense. So it's actually surprising to me that more, that it didn't become more of a dominant trend, which still perplexes me, why, we still have over 90% of people doing this ritual. But clearly it was a concern, and we have once Rabbi Chaim of Brisk, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik's father, was attending a conference about standing Torah scholars in St. Petersburg. The item on the agenda was the question of uncircumcised infants. Should their names be entered in the official registers of the Jewish community? All the rabbis declared it's forbidden to register them, for they are not circumcised. Through this tactic, they hope to compel the assimilationists to circumcise their sons. Rabbi Chaim arose and said, "My masters, please show me the halakha which states that one who's not circumcised is not a member of the Jewish people. I'm aware that a person who's not circumcised cannot partake of the sacrifices or the heave offering, but I'm unaware that he is devoid of the holiness belonging to the Jewish people. To be sure, if he comes of age and doesn't circumcise himself, he's liable to karet. However, he who eats blood and he who violates the Shabbat are also liable to karet. Why do you treat the uncircumcised infant so stringently and the Shabbat violator so leniently? On the contrary, this infant has not yet sinned at all, except that his father has not fulfilled his obligation. So Rav Soloveitchik, the son, comes along and says, from a political and practical perspective, and as an emergency measure, no doubt the majority was correct, but on the basis of pure halakha, Rav Chaim was correct. So we have clearly the concern that that the assimilationists, or perhaps some in the reform movement, were going to stop circumcision, and the only like carrot that we can, the only threat we can hold over them is to say we're not going to register you as part of the Jewish people if you don't circumcise your sons. And this great rabbi says that's ridiculous, right? Whether you're circumcised or not has no bearing on your personal status, right? You're Jewish by virtue of being born Jewish, whether or not you're ever circumcised. And yet, it becomes such an important mark of Jewish peoplehood identity that these rabbis want to use it as a litmus test. And maybe we're hearing a little bit of echoes in a more dramatic past of, you know, the Maccabees, right? In the Book of Maccabees, where there were similar assimilationists who wanted to assimilate into Hellenist culture by not circumcising. And certainly, if they were going to participate in the gymnasium, and there it would be quite public. To distinguish yourself in that way, the naked Olympics. And there too, I think we see that tension. So perhaps this has been a tension throughout our history. But I hope what we've just introduced and given you some texts that you can think about and teach with your students is really the richness of this ritual, in that it can be understood in so many different ways, and maybe leaving us with the perplexing question of, you know, why are people still doing this in such large numbers? Obviously, this is a good thing from our perspective, but it's still an interesting, it's interesting to note. And, you know, and how can we help our communities find meaning, ongoing meaning in this ritual, in their families, both for boys, and of course, as David leaves with us, the challenge of thinking about how are we going to incorporate girls in this whole story, this whole picture. So thank you.